Well, welcome to today's Ag Sector Council webinar, where we will discuss food safety concerns in agricultural development. I'm Angela Records. I'm a science advisor and plant pathologist with USAID's Bureau for Food Security, and I'll be your moderator today. This webinar is hosted by AgriLinks, Feed the Future's technical knowledge sharing platform. AgriLinks hosts regular seminars and special events to facilitate the exchange of knowledge among practitioners. Visit agrileaks.org, where you can contribute to online discussions, submit resources, and post to the blog. Okay, so our speakers today are Ahmed Kablan, Jagger Harvey, and Delia Grace. Dr. Kablan serves as International Public Health and Nutrition Advisor with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. His work focuses on factors that lead to negative nutritional outcomes and nutrition integration. Dr. Jagger Harvey is director of the Feed the Future Innovation Lab for the Reduction of Post-Harvest Loss, led by Kansas State University. He's an expert on mycotoxin contamination of crops. And Dr. Delia Grace leads research on zoonoses and foodborne diseases at the International Livestock Research Institute in Kenya and the CGIAR Research Program on Agriculture for Human Nutrition and Health. Okay, at this time, I will invite our first speaker to present, Dr. Kablan.
Thank you, Dr. Records, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today, this morning, for a presentation or our webinar on food safety, and hopefully this will be the first one in a series of webinars to cover different aspects of food safety. The thing that we want really to cover in this aspect is why food safety is a concern in international agriculture and international development and for us at Feed the Future. If we look at the Feed the Future result framework, the top two targets or the top two objectives and indicator for our success are in the improved and in nutritional status and reduced poverty. So we really want to focus on these two things. And the way I see it, food safety and touch and affect these two things, the poverty from the income side and from the productivity, and it affects the nutritional status, it affects the reduction in stunting status. And hopefully, during this presentation, we will try to convince you the importance of food safety aspects on these two high-level goals and targets. If we look at the recent WHO report on the food burden diseases, you will see an astounding numbers that about 8 in 10 people who are suffer from food safety. And about of those, if you look at the small sectors of children under 5, they can carry up to 40% of the foodborne illnesses burden, with about 125,000 deaths every year or 30% of every year. In Africa alone, more than 91 million people are estimated to fall ill, and about 137,000 die every year. And about 60 million children under the age of 5 fall ill, and about 50,000 of them die from foodborne illnesses. And if we look at the major causes for food safety or the major categories, and Dr. Grace and Harvey, they will touch more specifics on those. But we have the pathogenic causes, we have bacterial, viral, parasitic, and then you have toxins, which are, and chemicals. The toxin is produced by either pathogenic or non-pathogenic, could be chemical. And those, if you look at the major categories, and again, this will be covered later in the webinar, the pathogenic sources represent the majority of all foodborne illnesses. The way that we look at food safety, if you look at the nutritional outcomes and nutritional status, to improve childhood nutritional status, reduce stunting, you have to look at it from multiple areas. So you have the food-based issues where you would have to give them safe, healthy, nutritious diet. And here you have the food safety concerns from pathogenic, bacterial, viral, or parasitic. And you have, of course, the from the fungal production, toxins, mycotoxins, and then you have, of course, other chemicals and pesticides. Also, you need to look at the microenvironment and the macroenvironment. And the microenvironment, it is what is inside the condition inside the child gut and intestines. And that's why it is environmental enterobiota is very important, the gut microbiome, and how healthy is that. is very important factors. And then if we look, we have to look at the food base, which is, of course, if we have everything good and we don't have enough diet, diverse diet, then that is not, we will not produce an impact. So we need a diet, a healthy, diverse diet. Fruit, vegetables, of course, animal source food is a major component of any healthy diet, for, especially for growing children, impact in development, and we can look at the legumes, and of course, the way we need people who will use the, to use this, so social behavior change component is very important. So if we look now at the, in several of the places, a lot of places where we work and feed the future, and the, you look at the major food component for them, they are grain-based, and that is what we have on the left side. The goal is to improve the diet diversity for better nutrition, and we want to add more of fruits, vegetables, we want to add more of the animal source food, eggs, milk, chicken, fish, etc. And this is really ultimately the goal that we want to have, and that will result in improved nutrition. And with this comes the concern of food safety. The more we are moving, so if we look at this graph, when we have a low diet diversity, you are also having a low concerns in terms of food safety, because you are having limited factors that could contribute to food poisoning or food borne illnesses. As you increase the diet diversity, you are also increasing the factors that could be introduced through the food that can contribute to an increased illnesses. You are adding more entry pathways for pathogenic bacteria and viral and others. You are adding for to produce more fruit and vegetables, you need to more import. You are needing using more pesticides. You are using more chemicals in the environment. You are introducing different types of mycotoxins that could represent a risk on the health. So, and that, of course, with the animal source food and with the eggs, milk, etc., you are also adding another medium to introduce for bacterial growth, microbial growth, and the delivery for these microbes. So, if we don't have if we don't approach it from a comprehensive systemic way where we will have the whole value chain considering the safety and entry point for food pathogens, we will not be delivering a huge favor here of, when we are cruising the diversity, because we might introduce a lot of pathogens that will ultimately lead to severe illnesses. And if we look at food safety and food security, you need, in order to achieve the optimum health, you need to combine the work between food safety and food security. And to achieve food security, of course, we know the factors for it. It is the access, utilization, or availability, but also we need the food safety, the safe component for it. We don't want to balance one over the other. We need to have both of them in check and balances throughout the whole value chain. And just if we look at it from the size of the farm, from the production side all the way to the serving, all the way to the table. Now, the concern, of course, we have in the field, major concern, especially when we work in the Africa and Southeast Asia and other countries, we have mycotoxins, fungal metabolites that are produced in the field, and those are toxicogenic. And the famous one and the biggest suspect is aflatoxin. But at the same time, we have through the soil, through the fertilizers, through the irrigation system, through the storage, through the receiving, through the sorting, we have entry point for other germs, for other bacteria and viruses and microbes and chemicals to enter the supply chain and our food. And that's where we want to be paying attention to it and trying to prevent this the process. And if we want to consider the type of contaminant, of course, sorry, I think the slide is a little bit moved, but we have the chemicals, we have pesticides spread in the fruit or vegetables, freezers, refrigerators, drugs, etc. And we have biological, and biological could, or what I call the pathogenic, viral, bacterial, fungal. And finally, this is the level of preparation of the human factor, physical, from hair, glass, paper, etc. They are still important, but not as a major concern as the biological and the chemical. Causes of food contaminations, of course, the entry point for them, again, I can't reinforce this, could be cross-contamination, could be during the sorting, could be the handling, could be a personal hygiene, But really where we can control during the, from the ag side, we are looking at from the production side, during the transport, the storage through the whole value chain. For the factor of personal hygiene, that's where we want to improve the essential hygiene practices from hand washing, from using the soup, and the preparation of the whole storage of the food, etc., covering the hair, etc., etc. But safe food preparation, safe food handling, it starts in the field all the way to the point when we are consuming it. Now, if we want to look at some of the challenges that we face at USAID in terms of food safety challenges, of course, the biggest one, and everyone talk about it, and it is the budget, low budget level, and we don't have really a standalone food safety project. One of the things, if you go and look for information, especially where we work in the developed, where we have in the development program, one lacking thing that's lacking is data. We don't have a lot of data. We don't have also a lot of interventions that are feasible, proven that where we can say this will work 100%. And of course, we have limitation on funding to carry out research and programs. Of course, we have too much focus on mycotoxins, and that's of course forced because we need to focus. Focus is very important. But we are focusing a lot in our research programs on mycotoxins. We have not paid enough attention to other sources of foodborne illnesses causes, such as pathogenic ones, or bacteria and viral. We need more coordination. We need more integrations between our different offices and bureaus, and we have different players that can very important, and each one play a role from Global Health, from Humanitarian Bureau, and our food security and others. And we are need to enforce the more coordination and involve the interagency players, including USDA and add others, such as the FDA, CDC, and other donors as well. We have, again, we need the evidence base for what work better, and we need better evidence linking the food safety to our high-level targets, such as stunting and poverty. Diverse diet is very important, and at the same time, food safety implication, as I mentioned earlier, increase with increasing the diet diversity, so we need to be careful as we are doing this. And we have a value chain focus, of course, as you know, and that is, and we suffer, this is a problem from the overconfidence in the sound practices, sound agronomy in the value chain will handle a food safety, but that's really not the issue. If we don't have, the way is it, if we have a lot of assumptions, that's when problems start to happen. We want to minimize the number of assumptions during our implementation of the program and our work to reduce the failures. And in terms of the importance for alleviating poverty, and again, if we don't have a sound food safety system, a sound food, safe and clean food, that will affect the trade, that will affect, of course, the people who are consuming the food, and that will affect the nutritional outcome. And we can't reinforce the, of course, we all know about the Food Safety Moderation Act, and the business will start affect the trade. If we can't produce a food and product from the agriculture in Africa and Southeast Asia, Latin America, where we work, that can be sold and transported globally, then we are affecting the income for these farmers. And in order, one of the things, the steps we took at USAID, we start by establishing an agency-wide food safety working group that in to improve the coordination among our different bureaus within the agency. And we have members from Food Security, Global Health, and from our colleagues at the Humanitarian Bureau, the and Food for Peace. And this is very important to start understanding the problem magnitude and acknowledging it. And we are looking for integrating our food safety and food quality as part of our nutrition program. And if you look, especially the first 1,000 days, of course we have we acknowledge and we understand mycotoxins are very important and particular challenges, especially where we work, due to the nature of dependent, heavily dependent on one crop or such as maize or rice or wheat for that, which are target for our crops for mycotoxins. But at the same time, we also understand the other point of entry for pathogenic contaminant. And thank you. Follow us on Feed the Future, and you can tweet at Feed the Future. I think that's the Twitter handle. Yeah, Julie agrees with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kablan, for an excellent talk. All right, so let's move over to our next speaker, Dr. Harvey.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for having me today. I want to talk a bit about mycotoxin contamination of crops in terms of both agricultural development in developing countries, but also as an issue that's faced by farmers here in the United States and then really in countries around the world. So it's a big challenge. It's very complex. And at the same time, we do know quite a bit about it. If you bring the right sets of people together in the right partnerships, and if we as researchers and policymakers and others challenge ourselves to really make the best use of the information at hand, empower the national partners on the ground in the countries where we want to have impact, and continue learning as we go along and challenging ourselves, really, I think we're seeing some emerging success stories that should give us quite a lot of encouragement in facing this daunting challenge. So mycotoxins are essentially chemicals that are produced by different fungi in the environment and that typically reside in the soil where we grow crops around the world. And as the name suggests, they are toxic to human health. And this is really a unifying challenge. They contaminate crops broadly. Some farmers and some crops may face more acute problems with this. It may be more recognized in some parts of the world. But really, this is something that the more we look into it, it's something that farmers around the world can really relate to and that we need to pay attention, draw lessons from diverse geographical and socioeconomic contexts so that we can all make sure that we have a safe harvest around the world. So on top of being toxic to human health, they also carry over into animal-sourced foods. So if livestock consume contaminated grains, for example, like on the left you can see the maize that's been contaminated by fungus that produces aflatoxin. If farmers sort out these moldy grains, then these can carry over into the livestock animal products. So zeroing in on aflatoxin, which is what I've been working on for quite a while now, what this is, it's produced by aspergillus-type fungi. These reside in the soil, in fields, in the tropics and subtropics, extending as far north into Texas and the southern U.S. and even beyond. These infect a range of crops, so as the crop is growing in the field, you can get infection during flowering. Insects are feeding on the developing grains. Also, at harvest, if you place the crops of corn, for example, on the soil, you can get contamination with this fungus. And then if you don't dry and store properly, it can either introduce the problem if it's not there or compound it if it's already there. So in humans and animals, in humans, first of all, it is recognized to be lethal in high doses with acute poisoning. It's also known as a potent carcinogen, so it causes cancer. And it's been associated with stunting of children's development and also immunosuppression and blocking nutrient absorption. So in other mammalian systems, like in livestock, for example, it can suppress the immune system. It seems like it may be doing that in people as well. And even if people have enough nutritious food, it's possible that having aflatoxin in their diets could really keep them from having good nutritional status nonetheless. So this is something that at the front of people's minds, and the public does know about it in different parts of the world. Here you can see that the Kenyan government in 2010 tested and found high levels of aflatoxin in the maize harvest that year. And then the question is, what do we do from there? How, as a research for development community, can we empower these governments who are taking these types of responsible steps so that we make sure that everyone has enough food and safe food? So during this time, Samuel Mutiga, who himself is from Kenya, was working with Rebecca Nelson at Cornell University in the U.S., and he came and worked with me in a lab that I established in Kenya at the Biosciences Eastern and Central Africa Hub. And the point of the BECA Hub is, when there are researchers who want to address key issues in agricultural development, these are high-end labs that they can access on the ground in Africa. And you can find out more at their website. So Samuel Mutiga did a survey of village maize mills and found that 39% of the maize during this 2010 outbreak was above the legal limit, including some maize samples brought in by farmers that was very high above the legal limit, so scary levels, and it justified that the government took measures. He also found that in western Kenya there were higher levels of mycotoxins as well, so we need to keep our eye even in places which are not recognized as hotspots for these issues. So then the aflatoxin risk again. Now, we know it's a big challenge, and it's very complex in terms of when it becomes a problem, whether we can predict when and where it's going to pop up, which type of season is risky. And that's because it depends first on the type of crop that you're growing, both in terms of the crop species and also the variety and type of crop. Since the fungus there in the local environment is what produces it, what fungus is there that has the potential to produce a lot of toxins? How is the crop managed in the field? Are there prevailing environmental conditions during the growing season that predispose the crop to more contamination? And how is the crop being treated after harvest? All of this comes together to determine the relative risk of contamination. And at the recent UN Environment Program, UN Environment Assembly, a few months ago, they discussed the fact that with climate change, it looks like crops are going to be more and more stressed. And these fungal toxins, mycotoxins, as well as plant toxins themselves, are going to become more of an issue and more frequent in places where they're already recognized as a problem. And it'll extend into Europe and North America as well, further than it has in the past. For example, a study by Felicia Wu recently estimated that the annual loss to the U.S. corn industry could be as much as $1.68 billion a year with the type of changes that are being anticipated with climate change. So here's a study out of Europe showing, under different scenarios of climate change, the spread of aflatoxin risk into Europe for maize. So again, you can see from left to right, under different scenarios, different amounts of climate change. Again, this is a problem that we all need to be focused on, and there are lessons that can be drawn the more parts of the world that we look at solutions. So then what it comes down to for us as a community is we need to reduce these toxins for all farmers and consumers in a really diverse set of contexts. So in order to do this, we really need to look along the value chain, so you know, all the way from planting to consumption. And in order to do that, first we need to look at how do we prevent contamination in the first place, which of course is the ultimate goal. And then even in places like Texas, where crops are very well managed, you can still have conditions that simply overcome our best efforts.
Your microphone has been turned on.
It becomes a problem. And how do we handle that when we have these contaminated commodities? So looking across the spectrum, you know, from where we can have the contamination occur at different steps, and then what we can do to address it, what we need to do is consider how we can integrate these different interventions, see which ones are most locally adapted, most affordable, also considering issues like empowering women in agriculture that's critical for development and improving livelihoods. So if we look first at pre-harvest, so when the crop is in the field, there is a technology called biocontrol, which uses a variant of the fungus that's naturally occurring that is incapable of producing the toxin. And this basically competes out the fungus in the environment, which produces the toxin. This is something that's used in the U.S., and it's being deployed in places like East Africa. In addition to this, also we can see win-wins with good agricultural practices. So just by making sure that farmers use, you know, deep tillage to reduce drought stress, use the appropriate amount of fertilizer, pay attention to planting time, potentially intercropping, also looking at which crops are less susceptible to these where they're farming, we can have a win-win because healthier crops are typically, as a rule of thumb, less susceptible to disease, just like in animals. So if we have higher yield, then it seems like this is a good driver to get resource-poor farmers to adopt and spend more resources on measures that can also improve the safety. In terms of at harvest, we need to look at harvest time and avoid soil contact. That's a very simple thing that can be done, which can reduce risk when farmers harvest onto the soil. And then at post-harvest, if it's not an issue already, it can become an issue with the introduction of the fungus from the environment. But if it's an issue already pre-harvest, then it can become very bad again. So here we have to look at testing. If we can't tell if the toxin is there, then it becomes challenging to address. And when it is there, there are ways of decontaminating or sorting. Or maybe we could look at alternative uses. In the U.S., you can use it for certain types of feeds where the livestock are less susceptible and people won't be exposed. But it really boils down to proper drying, making sure that the grains are dry enough, and storing it properly. And through that, measuring the moisture as well. And beyond this, if we can look at mathematical modeling and diagnostics that can be taken out into the field, then we can identify these hotspots as they're occurring and then take care of this problem as it emerges. So in terms of post-harvest loss, this includes losses in quantity. So in terms of insect pests, you can lose a lot of your harvest. And in terms of quality, such as with these toxins. It's estimated that a third of the loss, a third of what's harvested globally is lost. This is particularly true in developing countries where this can be even higher. And in terms of mycotoxins, this should read there is and some other types of post-harvest loss, there's not enough of an evidence base and methodologies need to be strengthened. So if we consider this holistically, we need to look at what's being applied elsewhere, how can we adapt it to different contexts, and really transform the limited success that we've had globally to secure so much of the harvest that's lost by taking things off the shelf, adapting them with partners on the ground, and putting them into use. So the Feed the Future Innovation Lab for the Reduction of Post-Harvest Loss is based here at Kansas State University. It has partners, top researchers from across the U.S. And also internationally. And we've been running for 2.5 years now. And what we're focused on is putting top researchers from around the world together, including at U.S. land grant institutions, and looking at how we can adapt and deploy technologies to address this problem. So we focus on essentially post-harvest loss and food waste of seeds and durable staple crops, so grains, oil seeds, and legumes, focusing on drying, storage, insect pests, and toxins, making sure that we build capacity in the countries and focus on nutrition and gender issues. We focus on maize in Guatemala and Ghana. We're looking at chickpea, maize, sesame, and wheat in Ethiopia, rice in Bangladesh, and with a buy-in from Afghanistan, tree nuts, raisins, and wheat. So again, we're looking at integrating approaches. So looking post-harvest, how can we get the right drying technologies, make sure those stay well stored, so adapting storage technologies, and then making sure that we can actually measure moisture out there. And making sure, again, that we involve the right people on the ground so that this will be a sustainable solution, and they can help us to address these issues moving forward. So in Bangladesh, we have a success. We've adapted a dryer originally from Vietnam, which was originally wrapped in bamboo mats, and you have a furnace. And this does a very good job of drying rice. And when paired with the right post-harvest storage solutions like the Fix bags here from Purdue University, and a moisture meter that's been developed in the program by Paul Armstrong at USDA ARS, a low-cost moisture meter, this is really a package that's being trained. Farmers are being trained, and this can be deployed to significantly reduce losses in rice. In Ghana, a KNUST University engineer has adapted a solar biomass hybrid dryer, which looks like a greenhouse. It has a furnace, and essentially this can dry quite a lot of grain at once. And this has been deployed at Penn's Food Bank near one of the biggest markets in the region. Along with adaptive storage technologies, you can see these Ghanaian-made storage water tanks that have been adapted for storage and with the moisture meter. So already there are 1,500 or so people benefiting from this, and we're looking at scaling up outside the project. So considering the road ahead, where you can see the corn being dried here on the road and exposed to all sorts of different potential food safety and post-harvest loss issues, how do we integrate all of these strategies together? So very quickly, we need to be sure that we're working with the right baseline information. We need good quality information. And for that, we need in-country technical capacity. There are some very inspiring people working on the ground. Working with them in the right way, we can have big impact. Making sure that we standardize the sampling and testing procedures is key. Making sure that we can get diagnostics on the ground where they're needed and inform that back so we understand the problem at a higher level is key. Again, if we do get contamination, what do we do with those grains? And then for policymakers and public health officials, what really is the overall big picture for the health risks? So in the interest of time, I'll skip through these last couple. But essentially, what we need to do is assess the baseline of what's going on and understand potential intervention. And by working with the right partners, including the private sectors and regulators and government, we can tackle this very complex challenge together and continue building on the successes we're already having. So I'd like to say thank Seize the Future and USAID, the project team members here and many others, Ahmed and the Ag Sector Council seminar organizers. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Dr. Harvey. And now at this time, we'll move on to our final speaker, Dr. Delia Grace. Dr. Grace,
yes.
Are you ready to go? Okay, great.
Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. And I'm happy to join you from Kenya. This short presentation is going to summarize some work which we've been doing at ILRI, the International Livestock Research Institute, and also the CRP on the CGIAR Research Program on Agriculture for Nutrition and Health, led by IFPRI. Some research which we've been doing over the last 10 years on food safety in informal markets. And this has been synthesized in some evidence pieces, one produced last year, a peer-reviewed journal article, and also the first book on food safety and informal markets. So you're going to get links to all of those. They're all freely available online, and please do check them out. So my presentation is going to focus on three areas. First, why food safety matters for development. Secondly, food safety solutions, what we've learned so far. And then lastly, some take-home messages. So foodborne disease has long been considered something which was perhaps trivial, which was food security was often regarded as something more important. Foodborne disease itself was often seen as a minor trivial disease. But all of that is changing, as in quite recently, we're starting to get our first good evidence on the high health burden of foodborne disease. But secondly, and also very importantly, how much people in developing countries are worried about foodborne disease, the concern over foodborne disease, and then, of course, the cost, the economic cost. But lastly, and this is particularly directed to a development audience, the high possibility that well-intended approaches to trying to improve food safety could actually make things worse. And that is why now, as food safety starts to come very fast up the agenda, is a good time to start thinking through the unintended consequences aspects of food safety solutions. So the health burden of foodborne disease. The first global assessment of foodborne disease was produced only last year, developed by the World Health Organization. And this very excellent report gives us our first solid evidence on why foodborne disease actually matters to human health. And as you can see from the report, the burden is comparable to the burden of what we call the big three public health diseases, that is malaria, HIV, AIDS, and TB, much, much higher than many policymakers thought. Unsurprisingly, most of this burden falls in developing countries. 98% of the burden falls in low and middle income countries. What is quite surprising to many is that of the known burden, and I must say that this report, this first evidence we have on foodborne disease is still relatively preliminary and has only been able to measure those burdens of disease where there was enough evidence to come up with some sort of a quantification. But still, it is reasonably clear that quite a lot of the burden, as you can see, is due to biological hazards, the microbes, the worms. Whereas if you ask people, if you ask policymakers and consumers, which we do a lot in developing countries, often their major concerns are the toxins, the pesticides especially. And it's not that pesticides are not a problem and they're not, and that you shouldn't worry about them, but when you look at the great known burden, it is definitely coming from the biological hazards. And therefore, one of the important messages coming out is that it makes sense to address efforts where burdens fall. Another interesting finding is that quite a lot of this burden comes from zoonotic diseases. That's what you can see green in the pie chart. These are pathogens which spread from people to from animals to people. And the importance of zoonosis is not so surprising, because when we look at the foods implicated in foodborne disease, and I should say here our evidence is much weaker than on the overall burden, but still there are some reasonable studies from different countries, and those show that the animal source foods, meat, milk, fish, eggs, and produce, are most often implicated in causing foodborne disease. And this is because these foods, which are highly nutritious, and we want to diversify our diets and eat more of them, are also very good matrices for the microbiological, the biological pathogens, which, as we've seen, are responsible for the great burden, a known burden of foodborne disease. But it's not just the health burden, it's also the psychological burden, the worry, the concern over foodborne disease. This is a USAID study from Vietnam, where they did a nationwide survey to look at, in people's lives, what were their greatest concerns. Surprisingly, food safety, along with employment, was people's number one concern, much higher concern than corruption, access to housing, energy security. So this is something we are seeing more and more in developing countries as they get richer, as they urbanize, that people, and as their food seems to get dangerous, more dangerous, people get more and more worried. And then the third aspect, of course, is the economic cost, the fact that foodborne disease is very expensive. Part of the expense is just in terms of the cost of illness, the cost of treatments, the foregone income while people are having to be treated. And of course, in developing countries, a lot of the costs fall on, or out-of-pocket expenses, which fall on poor people who can least afford it. We have much weaker evidence on the cost of illness than on the burden of the disease. But in developed countries and rich countries where they have good economic assessments, we can see that this is really a billion-dollar problem. And in poor countries where evidence is starting to emerge, there's also evidence that this is also very expensive. But apart from the cost of illness, there are other economic hurdles and costs associated with foodborne disease, and one of these is access to markets. Already, we can see that food safety standards often exclude small farms from export markets, and that as export markets tend to grow, unless you make a real intentional effort, the small farmers, the poor farmers, the female-headed farm households will drop out. Moreover, even in the domestic markets where we are seeing growing supermarkets, these tend to be supplied by richer and better-off farmers. So we have an actual burden for export and a raising burden also for high-value domestic markets. But the unintended consequences of food safety. And I'm going to be returning to this, and I talk a little bit about the food safety solutions. Two major things. One is when people try to make food safer by formalization, by standardization, by supermarketization, it tends to increase the price, which tends to put food, nutritious food, out of the access of poor people. In Kenya, supermarket milk costs a dollar a liter, But the wet market raw milk costs around 50 cents. That's important for poor mothers. And secondly, as we try to improve food safety by our valiant efforts to, you know, get aflatoxins out of the maize and pathogens out of the milk, we see markets differentiating by quality, and then there's a real risk that the substandard food gets targeted towards the poor. Another unintended consequence, as I said, is a common response to improving food safety is trying to upgrade value chains, intensify, turn into more formal food sectors. But what we see as food sectors formalize, women drop out. The informal sectors now tend to be, this is just some results from studies we've done in different value chains in Africa. Informal value chains have a high role for women, but as they formalize, women tend to fall out. So what can be done for making our food safer? We've shown it's a big health burden, that it has high economic costs, but that also it has trade-offs between food security and livelihoods, and especially gender. Different things have been tried to improve food safety in informal markets. The first approach often tried by policymakers is regulation. They try to upgrade new policies, more regulation, more legislation, emphasis on improving regulations. But it is quite obvious that this is not a very successful way of improving food safety, because everywhere we do these studies, and at ILRI we've now studied around 50 of these domestic informal market value chains, we find that large amounts of food do not meet the standards. There's a summary of some results on the screen, 100% of milk in Assam, 24% of boiled milk in Cote d'Ivoire. So it's clear that this approach of trying to put standards and legislation in place is not working very well. And in fact, when in some case studies we've looked at the impacts of taking a punitive inspect, detect and punish approach to food safety, and it tends to make it worse. This is a study from Uganda where we found that urban dairies were using a good number of food safety improving practices, but farmers who were harassed by authorities or who believed their occupation was illegal used less mitigation. And this is something we often see economists will tell us about. When something becomes illegal, and currently a lot of the food, maybe a third of the food in Africa is illegal, when it doesn't meet the standards, then you get black markets and even worse standards. So regulation legislation needs to be there. The framework needs to be there, but not enough. Can we modernize our way to food safety? This is very common belief among policymakers in developing countries. They think if only we could get to Walmart, if only we could get to modern food with supermarkets and chill cabinets and all the rest of it, the food would be safer. But actually, we're finding out now that the supermarketization, although it has been greatly encouraged, in many countries is taking off much slower than we thought. Moreover, the formal sector food is often much riskier than we thought, and the modern business models which we keep on trying to introduce tend to run into problems. I won't go into detail in the interest of time, but this is a study from Vietnam comparing how safe, how biologically contaminated pork was in the supermarkets in purple, in the wet markets, the traditional wet markets in a darker purple, and in the village in yellow. And you can see that the supermarkets had worse quality pork. And we've seen this in numerous studies now in value chains. Formal sector is often no better or worse. And here's another picture from Nigeria. This was set up as a modern abattoir, off the ground slaughter, everything good. You know, this was World Bank money which actually funded it. And 20 years after the abattoir was put in place, because of the, as we know, the issues of maintenance, keeping things going, it's easy to put in big infrastructure. It's hard to keep it going and keep it maintained. So 20 years later, you're left with a much worse food safety situation than if you had never built this big abattoir in the first place. So modernization has a role in it. These systems are modernizing, but we have to be very careful because they may make things worse before they make things better. Will good agricultural practices get a safe food? Well, I mean, we know that smallholders can be successfully integrated into export chains and produce very safe and acceptable food for the export chains. Although, as I mentioned earlier, they will drop out unless they are intentionally included by programs and other initiatives. And there's lots and lots of pilots. We all have dozens of projects we can show where we improved practices and safety for hundreds of farmers or even thousands of farmers. But as we know, pilots never fail and pilots never scale. And the evidence of large-scale implementation of good agricultural practices is, I'm afraid, much weaker. It's the same for farmer field schools. A big evaluation came out a couple of years ago, but basically all of the studies who have looked at attempts to bring good agricultural practices to scale for informal markets, informal domestic markets, they have all showed no success. So GAP may not get us there either. That all sounds not good news, but we do find some promising examples. Although I must say that these are still at small scale, and we still do not have good examples of mass improvements of food safety in developing countries' informal food sectors. So an area we've been working a lot is participatory risk analysis, and this is moving away from the, you know, inspect and punish model to a much more stakeholder-led way of trying to improve food safety, using the methods from participatory epidemiology and participatory rural appraisal. Part of it is the methods, but even more important is the approach. Here you see a researcher and a farmer, and you can tell who the researcher is because he's got better shoes, but you can tell it's a participatory appraisal because it's a very nice way that he is working with the farmer. One important message: although in all of these informal markets, wherever we look, the hazards are high, the risk to human health is very variable. So one important thing we have to find out is there a real risk? And if there is a risk, we manage the risk. We don't manage the hazards. Too much in the past, we tried to manage hazards, and we haven't got very far, and it's also been quite harmful for the poor. So manage the risk. Secondly, improvements designed with people, participatory approaches, with the people, for the people, from the bottom up, have been more successful than many of these approaches trying to either rapidly modernize, you know, rush ahead to the supermarkets, or else the ones which are coming in, experts coming in and telling other people what to do. For example, we did some work in Nigeria with peer training of butchers. This led to 20% more meat meeting the standards, and the cost was much less than the cost of illness saved. As I said, foodborne disease is very expensive. Likewise, we've been doing quite a bit of work on milk, working with the informal sector, not trying to ban it, not trying to modernize it, but trying to upgrade it little by little, step by step. We now have long-standing projects in India and Kenya, and now 10 years after the projects have ended, economic studies have shown that the approach was economically very beneficial. More importantly, it was sustainable and scalable. Many traders were involved, many are still in part, and millions of traders benefiting. So, take-home messages. Foodborne disease is very important for health, but also for development. And the unintended consequences of well-mentioned development can make livelihoods and food security worse, so we have to be careful there. Most foodborne disease is due to microbes and worms in fresh foods sold in wet markets, and the things most people worry about are not the things which make them sick and kill them. And this we know very well from risk assessment, that when it comes to understanding risks, people's intuitions are not very good. Hazards in wet markets are always high, but the risks are sometimes low. And again, people's perception is a very poor guide, which is why risk analysis is really important for understanding what to do. The control and command approaches to food safety have not been very successful, although they have had, you know, I'm not saying that we don't need legislation, but by itself it won't work. And solutions working with the informal sector in participatory ways are more promising. So with that, I'd like to thank you for listening and hope to answer questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Grace.